Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio for PRI. Well, today it's a new perspective on farmers' markets. Can the farmer make a living from what we buy? And is the market the answer to saving the vanishing family farm? Our guest went behind the scenes in markets from Hawaii to New York. She is food expert Deborah Madison, author of Local Flavors, Cooking and Eating from America's Farmers Markets. Our opinionated cheese authority, Steve Jenkins, has the secret fat code to cheese and his picks of the world's great sheep cheeses. David Rosengarten, the prince of the picky palate, is taste testing for the ultimate hot dog. Then we plumb the mystery of how cooks learn to let go of their art and move on with their lives, a la Martha Stewart. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. That number is 800-537-5252. So let's roll with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet Magazine.
Lynn, we've been out in the country outside of Traverse City, Michigan, looking for ice cream. And boy, did we find a nice place. It's called Moomer's.
And Moomer's refers to, I think, probably what a child calls a cow. You know, a Moomer. I mean, it's something that moos. I love that name.
It is a great
name.
I'm
going to start calling cows Moomers from now on.
Well, and the fact is that this ice cream parlor is a building surrounded by cows. If it's a nice day, you get your ice cream at the counter, walk outside, find a table, and gaze out upon fields of dairy cattle.
This is pretty convincing, isn't it? I mean, that this is fresh ice cream.
Oh, it really is. It's really dairy fresh ice cream. And it took us literally 3 days to find this place. Even though everybody knows about it and everybody loves it, nobody could or would give us directions to it. So we were like traveling all around the back roads, you know, looking for something called Moomer's. And then finally, in the middle of a patch of dairy land, there it was, radiating its glory at us.
What is it like? I mean, is it a place that you go and have a lunch, or is it just ice cream?
As far as I remember, they have no such thing as lunch. It's just an ice cream place. It's kind of a rustic log cabin-y type building. You walk up to the counter, place your order, and then carry it yourself to a table.
It's kind of rustic wood panel dining room with benches. Mm-hmm. Very, very unfancy.
Mm-hmm. And you can get a regular ice cream cone or a cup, or they have sundaes. They have a wonderful ice cream floats made with Michigan's favorite Werner's ginger ale.
You know, my favorite thing, Michael, was they had a flavor of the week called Cherry's Moobly. And it was, I mean, Michigan is kind of cherry central, that part of upper Michigan. And, I mean, what's better than farm fresh vanilla ice cream mushed up with Michigan cherries? And Cherry's Moobly was just perfect for me.
I will tell you what's better than that. And that is a turtle sundae at Moomer's. You know me, I'm passionate about turtle sundaes.
Michael, you're going to turn into a turtle in your next life.
As long as I don't turn into a turtle sundae, that's okay. Fine. No, a turtle sundae, as you know, Lynn, is hot fudge and caramel sauce atop ice cream. But the secret ingredient that really puts a great turtle sundae over the top is excellent, crunchy nuts on top of it. And at Moomer's, they top the turtle sundae with delicious, crunchy butter roasted pecans that really just crunch in your mouth, along with the fudge and caramel and vanilla ice cream. It's really one of the great ice cream treats there is.
But if you're a kid, unlike the Sterns, who were just kind of perennially mentally kids, when we went to Moomer's, there was a second grade class from the local elementary school that had taken a field trip to Moomer's, and all the kids were eating Mooberry ice cream, which was kind of the spectacular blue and red stripes. So I think if you're under the age of 7, go for the Mooberry.
Now, are they making this ice cream right there?
They are making it. You don't see it, but they make the ice cream in the back of Moomer's. So it is freshly made ice cream, and you know, it really tastes it. we who don't have access to freshly made ice cream all the time get accustomed to what we buy in the freezer. And what a difference there is between that and ice cream that is made on premises from milk, from on-premises cows.
I like this. The cows walk up, give milk in the back, and walk on down the line and graze a bit. Is there any place else in Traverse City that we should not miss?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. The place you want to go to is Aunt Jenny's, which has Upper Peninsula pasties, which are the Cornish meat pies that are folded over and kind of like beef stew and a crust. Mm-hmm. And this is the only place that I can think of in the lower UP that has pasties. There's also the Cherry Hut, Michael.
The Cherry Hut, south of Traverse City in the town of Beulah, Michigan, has specialized in cherry pies since 1922. And this is cherry country, and they make the best cherry pies on earth.
And in cherry season, if you just travel along the roads around Traverse City, there are countless little farm stands selling, you know, 2 pounds of big, gorgeous black cherries in a bag, just ready to eat. And I mean, for me, that is just kind of cherry heaven.
Okay, guys, we're going to head for the Traverse City neighborhood. Thanks a lot.
Right. And Moomers.
Moomers.
Bye, Lynn.
Goodbye.
If you're feeling fancy free, come wander to the world with me. And any place we chance to be will be our rendezvous. Two for the road.
Jane and Michael Stern have updated their great guidebook classic, Road Food. Now, you can hear them here every week on The Splendid Table, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to our website, splendidtable.org. Cheesemonger Steve Jenkins is a pioneer. Long before many people knew what artisan meant, he was tracking down hard-to-find artisan cheeses all over Europe and the United States. He's the author of Steve Jenkins' Cheese Primer and a man who has never held back on an opinion. Steve, good to have you with us.
Ah, oh, Lynn, it's always so much fun to talk to you.
So what have you been mulling?
I'm mulling sheep's cheeses, and I didn't say cheap cheeses. I said sheep's cheeses.
You mean you're in bed at night, and this is what you're thinking about?
I look at the ceiling, and I think about cheese.
So what about the cheese of sheep?
Well, the characteristics of sheep cheeses are that the fat globules are the biggest of any animal's milk. Sheep's cheeses are the richest.
Huh.
Doesn't mean they're the most fattening or the most cholesterol-laden, because that's an issue as to how hard the cheese is. Don't forget, Lynn, softer the cheese, the lower the fat and cholesterol. The harder the cheese, the higher the fat and cholesterol. So there's a lot of great, great sheep's cheeses out there that aren't necessarily rock hard like Pecorino Romano,
mm-hmm,
that bring such joy to me that there is never an instance where I serve cheese for the people I love to be with that doesn't include at least one sheep's milk cheese.
What are your picks? What do you want us to try?
I want you to know that France and Spain and Italy and the United States offer great sheep's cheeses.
I understand.
In France, the Pyrenees offer sheep's cheeses that are sublime, and there are many of them, from the name brand ones like Prince de Claverolles and Etourqui, to the ones that are actually name controlled that we call Osso Irati, which is a valley and a tiny village, O-S-S-A-U and then -I-R-A-T-Y. They'll all say that, and there's a variety of them. Erhaki, which proclaims its Basque Pyrenees origin with its name. Where else would it get a funny name like Erhaki? But then in Corsica, there's the great Brandamore, which another maker refers to as Fleur du Maquis, which is a great, soft, pillow, square-shaped sheep's milk cheese that's coated with the herbs from the Maquis in Corsica, the Maquis being the brambly undergrowth where outlaws hide out and where the game is that results in a lot of the cuisine of Corsica. I'm talking about rosemary and juniper berries and coriander seeds and savory on the outside of this beautiful sheep's milk cheese. Magnificent stuff. And then in Roquefort, Lynn, I get so excited when I think about the Perail, P-E-R-A-I-L, or its branded namesake, Louperac, L-O-U-P-E-R-A-C, is a disc about as big around as a hockey puck, but about a half an inch thick of this beige stuff that you have to eat with a spoon because it's so oozy. It's the cheese that the Roquefort makers make with what little milk they have left over. They make Perail for themselves. Oh, man, they are so fine, I can't even tell you. And even Portugal has got a half a dozen magnificent cheeses that are becoming widely available in shops across the United States, and I urge people to jump all over any Portuguese cheese. It's going to be sheep's milk or a blend of sheep and goat, and they are so fine, I cannot tell you how good they are.
So if it says made in Portugal, we give it a shot.
Exactly. The same way I say if it's made in Catalonia, give it a shot. All you got to do is see the words Catalonia or Portugal on any damn thing. Jump all over it. And don't forget that ricotta is made from the whey that's left over from making Pecorino Romano. Real ricotta is sheep's milk. And if you can find that, or its counterpart, ricotta salata, which is an authentic cheese, you have access to a very inexpensive and magnificently versatile cheese in ricotta salata for salads and for bean dishes and to grate onto gratins and things. And the Greek manouri, M-A-N-O-U-R-I, which I like even better than ricotta salata because it has more of a buttery flavor, is a great, great choice for us to make with sheep's milk cheeses.
Steve, thank you.
Too much information, not enough time.
Well, Steve Jenkins is author of Steve Jenkins Cheese Primer. Steve can be found behind the counter of Fairway Markets in New York City, but you can get his sheep cheese picks right on our website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, take a look at the Splendid Table store. There's something there that would be really great with Steve's cheese picks. Sheep cheeses take beautifully to caramelly sweet flavors. And I've got a tasting trio for you. It's three brown sugars from Mauritius, and they taste nothing like commercial sugars. They are really distinctive. There's this super dark molasses sugar. There's a medium brown sugar that's called Muscovado. And then there's this pale, tawny Demerara. Try them crumbled on the sheep cheese or stir them into iced tea and lemonade. Obviously, they're perfect for baking. Now, the brand is Billington. They're around in food shops, and they're at the Splendid Table store. Find it at splendidtable.org. Coming up, Deborah Madison with a new take on farmers markets, taste testing hot dogs, and open lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio for PRI. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show about life's appetites. What's the story behind the explosion of farmers markets. Now, if you think about it, the farmers market should be the touchstone of local economies. It's where you get food directly from the land. There's no middleman. You buy right from the person who raised that tomato, the farmer. So is the farmers market the answer to keeping the family farm? Our guest today helps run a farmer's market and his research markets from Hawaii to New York City. She is the award-winning cookbook author, Deborah Madison. Her new book is Local Flavors, Cooking and Eating from America's Farmer's Markets. Deborah, it's good to have you back on the show.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure to be here.
Well, Deborah, can a family farm survive on what they sell at the market?
I think some can. I think it's a very complicated question that's answered with a lot of, it depends. It depends on where that farmer is, what kind of a community, level of support they get. Are shoppers in that market really willing to pay the prices that they need to be paying for good locally grown food? Is land very expensive, or does that farmer own it? The cost of driving, going back and forth, all those things enter into it. But in short, I think that it's the best hope, if not perhaps the only hope, for the family farm. When I look around at farmers markets, I'm seeing young farmers who are committed and who are there season after season, who are farming full time, who are raising families. And to me, that's a very optimistic sign that it might actually be possible to make a living being a family farmer.
Yeah, we keep hearing about people are leaving the land because they can't afford to stay, and now you're saying young people are coming onto it. That's great.
Yeah. The average age of the American farmer is something like 60. And, I mean, that's terrible. I mean, you might ask where our food is going to come from. So to see young farmers at a farmer's market is even more important when you set that against, you know, an average age of being an age where someone wants to retire.
So the element about where it can pay is that they're selling directly to the end consumer and getting more money for their goods.
Yes, absolutely. And they're selling to an increasingly more educated consumer who understands more about what it is they're getting, that they're not going to the farmer's market for a bargain. They're going to the farmer's market for value and for food that's incredibly delicious, that's alive, that's nutritious, that hasn't been sitting somewhere in a warehouse or a walk-in for 2 or 3 weeks. And it doesn't come cheap. It shouldn't come cheap.
Yeah, I remember reading something about the average farmer gets 7 cents on whatever the item might be, whereas we buy it for $1.50.
And it changes hands like 4 or 5 times between the farmer and the grocery store. And farmer income is the only income that goes steadily down each year rather than up.
Well, what does it take to do a market, to create a market?
Oh, it takes so much work. The thing about markets, one of the things I think people like about a farmer's market is that they spring up overnight. Gee, you know, there was an empty parking lot or a rail yard or a church parking lot or street on Friday night. And guess what? On Saturday morning, there's 50 or 100 farmers, or maybe just 7 farmers. And it just looks as if it sprung up overnight. But it has to be managed. It has to be planned for. Someone has to get out there and set up flags and trash cans and signs. And that same person is probably going to put all that away when the market is over. There's advertising. There's working with your city government to obtain a space, and to you have to negotiate with your neighbors to make sure they're comfortable having you there. There's a matter of getting insurance for the market, insurance for some of the producers. And then there's the whole job of growing the market, not just the size of the market, but also the content, shaping the market by how the manager fills it with what kinds of farmers, what kinds of choices they make. Do they have resellers or only farmers? Are there crafts or no crafts? Will there be prepared food or not? These are all questions that have to be answered by a manager or by a board or by a team of people working together. And that's not all.
How many markets did you visit?
Oh, I visited around 100, probably a little bit more, markets over a number of years. I keep remembering markets I'd forgotten.
So with all of that, was there anything new that you learned?
Oh, I'm always learning new things. I was exposed to a lot of foods I hadn't seen before, that I'd heard of and read about, but I'd never encountered, like muscadine grapes in Alabama, or green peanuts, butternuts, and black walnuts, gooseberries, huckleberries, foods I've really seldom come across because, in fact, they're very, very regional foods.
Do you have any clues for us? Are there ways we can experience this market that we have in our neighborhood? You know, tricks to shopping.
Oh, tricks to shopping. I think the most important thing is to slow down. Yes, this isn't the supermarket. You don't have to gear up, you know, and hunch your shoulders and get behind your basket and run through. Another is ask questions. If you see something you don't know, you don't know how to cook, it's unfamiliar, just ask in a fairly loud voice and somebody's going to give you an answer. It might be the farmer and it might be somebody standing behind you who you've never met before. Actually, you can make friends at the market doing that. It's happened to me.
It's travel time. Are there a couple of gems, and I know this is a tough question, but if there are a couple of farmers markets that are kind of out of the way that we might miss that you want us to go to?
It is a very tough question, because I haven't yet met a farmers market I wasn't thrilled to be at, but I did think of a couple. One of my favorite little tiny markets, and it's really out of the way, is on Lummi Island in the San Juans. It's a tiny little island, only 7 miles long, and at the market, you not only know that the food came from the island, you know whose backyard it came from. Everybody knows each other. You'll be able to buy wild blackberry pies from the person who gathered those berries, and she has scratches on her arms to prove it. You'll be able to get a delicious fresh cheese, pastured chicken, gorgeous organic eggs, asparagus, artichokes, fish. It's a tiny market, maybe 7 vendors.
This is the Pacific Northwest, right? The San Juan Islands.
Yeah. Another one is Washington, D.C. And Washington, D.C. is not an out-of-the-way place. It's full of tourists in the summer. But people might not know that in DuPont Circle, there's a wonderful market called the Fresh Farm Market. It's one I've visited several times, and I've watched it go from a little tiny market to a much bigger market. There's beautiful, beautiful food there, including some gorgeous artisanal cheeses that shouldn't be missed. Do you want a third?
Sure.
I have to say Madison, Wisconsin, for the main reason that this market is so magnificent. It's 300 farmers. It's 8 city blocks surrounding the Capitol with great big trees and grassy lawns. And the feeling of being there is that it is somehow blessed, that this is the way it should be. I don't know what it is about that market, but that's how it made me feel. And I can never get away from it.
Mm-hmm. Deborah Madison, thank you.
Thank you, Lynn.
Deborah Madison is author of Local Flavors, Cooking and Eating from America's Farmers Markets. Now, we couldn't let her get away without leaving us with some of her recipes. They're always incredible. Deborah's left us with an entire menu. It's called A Late Summer Vegetarian Feast. There's a leek, scallion, and fennel gratin, and slow-roasted tomatoes, a great dessert. You can find the entire menu of recipes right on the website, splendidtable.org. To an issue seldom addressed on this show, the issue of finding the finest hot dog for home consumption. I can think of only one man to address this pressing question. He is the man with the golden palate, David Rosengarten. Cookbook author, wine expert, TV chef, and creator of The Rosengarten Report, a food and wine newsletter. David tastes, David evaluates, and David tells all. David, welcome back.
Yes, it's bite and tell. Thank you, Lynn. Great to be here.
Well, okay, David. Hot dogs. You did a hot dog tasting. How many did you taste?
This was a fairly light tasting. We tasted only about 100 different hot dogs, a little less than 100. But as always with my tastings, I'm looking for those products that are shippable across the country. And if something's only available locally somewhere, I won't taste it. So it's about 100 dogs.
Okay, now you divided these into categories, and I'd never heard of this before. Tell us about the categories.
Exactly. And I'm glad you say that, because some people have looked at this article and said, oh, so are those the standard categories? But no, these are totally idiosyncratic. These are my categories. As I tasted through, I found that the hot dog world divided very clearly into two big categories. And then there's sort of a third, which I'll mention in a moment. But the two big ones are, I grew up in New York, and I also love hot dogs in Chicago. And those dogs are basically the same type of dog, which is to say they're quite reddish, they're garlicky, they're highly seasoned. Then there's a totally other kind of dog, and I came up with the name for it of bologna dog, because it reminds me of nothing so much as, you know, bologna from the supermarket. It's a paler pink. It's got less garlic and usually has a little bit more of a smoky flavor than the New York Chicago dog. We also found a few dogs out there that were a little coarser than normal hot dogs. So we made a third category called the coarse dog.
Okay. I want to know the winners in each one of the three categories.
Mm-hmm. Well, we had ties all over the place, but I'm going to pick a couple of winners for you. In first place in the bologna dog category, and Lynn, you know, when you think about these dogs, you have to think about guys who came from Vienna about 1910 and have that whole tradition behind them of, you know, the Germanic type of light, moussey, fluffy hot dog. As a matter of fact, I just flew through Munich the other day, and I had one in the airport. It was fantastic. But number one in the bologna dog, Schaller and Weber. And they're based in New York City. And these guys came over here from Germany in 1937. And they're making just wonderful classic examples. But the important thing is, if you contact them, you have to ask for the wieners, because they make a number of other hot dogs as well. But the one I'm talking about is the Schaller and Weber wieners. Wieners.
Weber's wieners, yes.
Yes, okay. Exactly.
All right. What about the Chicago, New York hot dog?
Yep. New York, Chicago dog, the number of contenders, but I'm going to have to give number one to, there's a butcher shop in Manhattan, which people in this neck of the woods know as the most insanely expensive butcher shop in the world, but they've also got the most insanely high quality. And so I took a gamble and called them up and said, do you guys happen to have a hot dog and along with the filet mignon? And they said, oh, we certainly do. So I got some and I tasted it and it came out my number one. They won't tell me who makes it, but they tell me that an Austrian-born guy who lives in Brooklyn and is 80 years old makes them exclusively for Lobel's butcher shop and nobody else has them. And Lynn, most hot dogs in this tasting cost in the vicinity of maybe, you know, $2 to $3 a pound.
Right.
These puppies are $14.98 a pound.
Ay-yi-yi-yi. Okay.
But they are so beautiful. They're little works of art.
All right. What about number three, the coarse dog?
Yes, in the coarse dog category, we only had two because there aren't that many around. But a company in Virginia called Edwards and Sons. They make an absolutely wonderful coarse dog. I said in my newsletter, caught somewhere between the seasoning and snap of a New York dog, the smoke of a Midwest dog, and the chew of fatty kielbasa, which makes me very happy.
So you can mail order all these, but is there anything in the supermarket that you really loved?
Well, you know, we were very sort of egalitarian about this. We took everything, we threw everything in there. I did the tastings blind, and all the standard supermarket products were in there. Lynn, though I'm a man of the people, I have to say that I didn't find a supermarket dog that I loved. Didn't find one that finished anywhere in the rankings.
I'll be darned. Well, okay, let's go to toppings. What's your take on what you put on the dog?
It is so interesting. As I started to explore the subject, I found not only are there interesting variations across the U.S., but around the world. People eat hot dogs everywhere. And a couple of months ago, I was a judge at a food contest in Reykjavik, Iceland. And of course, as always, I'm saying to everybody, well, what's local? What do people really eat around here? Because, you know, in Reykjavik, the restaurants are like Chicago or San Francisco or Hong Kong or Sydney or anywhere. It's all right. That international food, fancy creative food. But, you know, they said, oh, we have great hot dogs. Really? So I made them take me out to the hot dog stand. And what we got here was a steamed dog. It was kind of like a bologna dog. It got smeared with a sweet red sauce that tasted something like barbecue sauce.
Yeah.
On top of that came the master stroke, a layer of crispy, crunchy fried onion bits. And then after that, there was yellow mustard, what they called a remoulade sauce, kind of a green-tinged mayo. And that was basically it. But the crunchy onion, I mean, you could just open the can of those crunchy onion things and put them on your dog.
The jerky onions.
The jerky onions,
yeah.
Exactly.
Hey, David, thank you.
Certainly, my pleasure.
David Rosengarten is author of Taste and creator of the Rosengarten Report newsletter. You can find his hot dog champs on our website, splendidtable.org. You know how some people see food simply as fuel, while others, like David Rosengarten, see it as life itself? Well, commentator Julie Hauserman is beginning to see food as art.
This might be a cheap shot, talking about Martha Stewart, but one time I watched transfixed for an hour as she made a wedding cake. You had to use geometry to make this cake, and a jigsaw. It was a series of descending octagon layers with a hard, thin layer of marzipan in each octagon. It wasn't a cake. It was a building project. You had to make giant, stiff marzipan sheets ahead of time. You had to have a separate refrigerator in which to lay the marzipan sheets carefully to harden overnight. Martha used a jigsaw and a ruler and high school geometry proofs to make the marzipan layers, which looked like paper-thin stop signs. One slip of that saw, and you ended up with marzipan slivers. Not a good thing. The cake layers, of course, had to be carefully trimmed, too, and the whole thing was held together by support beams made of wooden barbecue skewers. Meanwhile, she whipped up a fluffy homemade frosting. Then the real topper. She made magazine-spread perfect marzipan fruits, too pretty to eat. These were clustered atop the cascading cake. At the end, she said, "This is really a very simple cake." This is really a very simple cake? I am the sort of person who tries to bring water for the lemonade to a potluck. But I watched Martha like she was a Tibetan monk making a mandala out of sand. After days of meticulously pouring sand into a beautiful pattern, the monk sweeps his art away. The knife cuts through the marzipan fruits, sinks past the paper-thin marzipan layer, and all you've got left is crumbs. Cooks learn to let go right then, like the existential artists in New York City who did fabulous paintings and buildings set for demolition. The art is in the doing, in watching the doing, in that moment where people go, oh, at the beauty of it, the thing you made. Is it eating or is it art? Do we cook for ourselves or for our audience? Is the best part hanging out in the kitchen, your friends around to cheer when you flip the cappellini cake with the caramelized onions artfully onto the plate and it lies there, gorgeously crusty brown? That's one side of the food as art equation. The other side is the admirers. You know us. We show up with the bottle of wine, or the water for the lemonade, and stand in your kitchen, devouring your marzipan fruit and smiling.
When Julie Hauserman is not perfecting her marzipan flowers, she's a Capitol reporter in Tallahassee, Florida for the St. Petersburg Times. Well, it's time for our weekly trivia challenge. Here's the question. What's the inside term waiters and waitresses use to describe an analytical eater? You know, the thing they use in the kitchen, behind the kitchen door. Now, we're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be taking your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio for PRI. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. Now, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. The number is 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what's the inside term that waiters and waitresses use to describe an analytical eater? Well, the answer is a Julia Child, as in the Julia Child at Table 10 just performed chemical analysis on the pasta sauce. Of course, Julia is the last person to do this. In fact, she's usually the one at the table deflecting this tendency that we food people have to kind of pick and pick and pick. But I found some other great idioms from the restaurant world. They're all in the book called Idiom Savant by Jerry Dunn. How about when a waiter refers to a customer as Duke? Well, what he's saying is, this guy's a tough number who thinks he knows everything, a la John Wayne. Or when a maitre d' says to a waitress, I'm quoting here, we've got a VSOP at 7:30, be sure to fluff and fold him. Translation? VSOP means very selectively opinionated person. It's the notation put in a reservation book to tip off the staff. And fluff and fold means handle with care. The lines are officially open, and you can reach us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's get right to the phones. We've got Dawn on the line. Hey, Dawn, what's on your mind? What do you want to talk about?
Hi, I have a whole salmon.
You lucky thing.
And I was hoping to find out from you what you would suggest in terms of barbecuing a whole salmon.
Ooh, how big is it?
It's pretty big. I don't have the exact pounds, but I'd say it's probably a good 6 pounds, 7 pounds.
Uh-huh. Okay. Boy, I think grilling it would be great. The only hitch is turning, because it can break up, you know? And okay, this is what I would do with it. Do you have access to a lot of fresh herbs? Great. Here's the thing. I would take some slices of lemon. Mm-hmm. All right. I would take bunches of basil, a little bit of thyme, and something like some mint, and a ton of garlic. And I'd bruise that all up, and I'd stuff it in the stomach.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And then the next thing, and salt and pepper the stomach.
Right.
All right. I'd rub the whole outside with olive oil.
Mm-hmm.
I'd salt and pepper that.
Mm-hmm.
I'd make some... No, you know what? Before you do that, make some slashes.
Right.
Not all the way down to the bone, but, you know, like about a quarter inch into the animal.
Uh-huh.
And then rub salt, pepper, olive oil, and if you want, some garlic into that.
Right.
And I would get two long spatulas, the kinds of things that you can really slip under the salmon so you can easily flip it.
Mm-hmm.
Oil the grill really, really well. And you're going to have to cook this slowly. You can't do it too fast, because you're going to get raw on the inside and overdone on the outside. So at the bottom of your grill, put a drip pan. It can be just an old foil pan of some kind. And make a pile of coals on either side. And when the ash is gray, lay the salmon on that oiled grill. And I would cook it. You always figure about 10 minutes to the inch of thickness. So
right.
Let's say it's 3 inches thick. That's going to be about 30 minutes. Halfway through that, you turn it very carefully.
Okay.
And if you want to get fancy, you can take a bouquet of basil and or rosemary, of herbs, and you can be dipping it in olive oil and garlic and brushing the salmon. Yeah, I mean, it would just be fabulous. And so figure about 10 minutes to inch of thickness.
Okay.
And I think it will be wonderful. And
sounds
you're
good.
Very lucky to have a whole salmon. Hey,
thanks. Very much.
Thank you.
Okay.
Cooking a whole salmon, there's another great way to do it. And that is to poach the baby. And one of the ways you can do it, I'm not talking about going out and buying an expensive fish poacher. This is what I did years ago. I have used it a total of 4 times. But if you've got an old turkey roaster, this is what you do. Measure the length of the roaster and then go out and measure the fish. And that's how you buy the salmon. The fish should be about 2 inches shorter than the roaster. And what you want to do is put together a mixture of white wine, all kinds of green herbs. Just don't overdo the thyme or the sage or the rosemary, because that'll kind of kill everything. A lot of garlic and water. So equal parts white wine and water, ton of herbs, garlic. You can even throw in a little chili pepper if you want. And you bring that to a simmer in the turkey roaster on top of the stove. You slip in the salmon, you put a lid on it, and you very, poaching is where the water just kind of goes, you know, it shudders. It doesn't bloop. And when the, you figure 10 minutes to the inch. Very gentle, very gentle. And you can put it in cheesecloth, so that like a cheesecloth sling, and you just lift it out, let it cool down in the fridge, peel back the skin, because it's gorgeous and pink. Cover it with scales of sliced cucumbers, very classy stuff, and little wedges of lemon here and there, and you serve it cold with good mayonnaise. Not a bad idea. Okay, reach us at 800-537-5252. We've got Josh calling. So, Josh, what do you want to talk about?
Well, I have a question about pesto this morning, Lynn.
Oh, okay.
My wife and I, we love pesto, and we love the basil that comes in so great in the summer.
Right.
And we've been experimenting with different ways to enjoy that throughout the year. And I had two quick questions. The first is, do you have any special tips on how to keep basil fresh tasting throughout the year to make pesto in the middle of winter?
The best, all-time best way is to freeze it. It's going to darken.
Right.
But, you know, when you make pesto, it darkens anyway.
That's true. But is it best to freeze it whole or to chop it first before we...
I would freeze it whole.
Okay.
You rinse it, you let it completely dry.
Okay.
I just put it on the drain board, sort of branches of it upside down.
Okay.
And when it's really dry, and there's no flecks of moisture on the leaves, I take all the leaves and I stuff them in heavy plastic bags and I seal them really well. I get all the air out of it and
yeah.
I stick it in the freezer.
Well, that's exactly what we've been doing, and that's been pretty successful. The next question is a little bit more tricky. Do you know of a way that to make it such that we could give it away, say, for Christmas? And the same way people do things for jams and jellies.
Yeah.
And vegetables. Is there any way that you know of for making pesto that would work to store it and give it away?
This is the problem.
Okay.
Traditionally, people just make it and cover it with oil.
Right.
And I think that's a real dangerous thing to do because you're encouraging those little botulism beasties to start growing there.
Right.
You know what you could do? And this is not as elegant, perhaps, as you would like. You could take your frozen basil, make the fresh pesto combination.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that combination holds well in the freezer for a long time.
It doesn't.
But you know that. But the other thing is, for a month or 3 or 4 weeks, and you could give it to people it frozen in an attractive container,
mm-hmm.
but right on the container with a nice label or something, exactly what they should do with it. Give them the instructions and say, please use me within 2 weeks
okay.
or 4 weeks. I'm dying to make you happy. Something like that.
Okay.
Something like that. The other thing is give it to them fresh made with the pasta.
Well, we do that in season all the time.
Yeah.
And that's a really big hit. And we just thought that there might be some way to possibly do it that we haven't thought of. And
yeah. I wish I could tell you that it'll hold forever under olive oil, but it's too dangerous. The other thing is, if you give it to them fresh and you put it in a nice, attractive container with the pasta, and you can put a note on saying, forget the roast goose and the beef, it's time for you to have a really great dish of pasta. Make this tomorrow night.
Yeah,
okay. This is the thing.
Well, thank you so much.
You are welcome.
I love listening to your show every week.
You got me wanting pesto now. Hey, Josh, thanks a lot.
If this worked out differently, I would have sent you some.
I like that, except we'd all die from it, so that's all right.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Freezing herbs, best way to go. Best way to go. Everywhere I look, Melons are in season right now. There's some neat stuff to do with them. Yeah, you know, I mean, the business about you sprinkle some lime or sugar on them and you eat them, that's great. But if you look up on the website, there's Jerry Traunfeld's great recipe for tarragon and honey on melon. And I've also got a Thai salad up there. This is so easy. You get some basil. If you can get Thai basil or lemon basil, all the better. But you take any melon that's really lush and sweet, cut it into chunks, tear the basil over it, sprinkle it with a little rice vinegar, some salt, black pepper, and then chop up some hot chili and put that over it. So, full with melons. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Let's see who's up. We've got Laura waiting. Hey, Laura, what do you want to talk about?
Well, I would like to talk about chocolate.
Oh, that sounds good.
I have been using the regular store-bought cocoa.
Yeah.
And I think it's time to upgrade a bit. I would like to find the habanero of peppers, is the pepper of peppers.
Yeah.
I'd like to find the chocolate of chocolate.
You mean for cooking?
For cooking, yes.
Okay, mm-hmm. Because, you know, cooking chocolate is different in some ways than eating chocolate.
Okay.
I always think with cooking chocolate, you want something that has a really powerful taste,
mm-hmm.
that isn't going to be muted by eggs and heat.
I think that's my problem.
Yeah, and other ingredients. There are two brands that I always go back to.
Mm-hmm.
And I taste chocolate. I taste chocolate anytime I can. But there are two brands I really like. One is Valrhona, and the other one is Lindt, and that's Lindt. And you've probably seen both of these. If you go into any of the fancier grocery stores, they're there.
Okay.
But, and they're not, I wish I could tell you they were inexpensive, but boy, brace yourself. But the thing about them is that what you want, and they make different kinds of chocolates, you know, different levels of bittersweet and that kind of stuff.
Right.
You want something that is 71% or more cocoa mass.
All right.
That's like saying this is high test chocolate.
Uh-huh.
And it's bittersweet. And it's usually right there on the label.
Mm-hmm.
And in the case of Lindt, Lindt actually has one that has this big 71% on the label. If you want to save some money, and you know you're going to use a lot of chocolate, or you have friends you know are going to use chocolate, because chocolate will keep for a year easily. Mm-hmm. There are some sources that you can buy, like blocks, like 11-pound or 10-pound blocks of some of these chocolates.
Chocolate heaven.
Yeah, you got it. And one of them, and I think it's on the web, is called New York Cake. And it's a supply house for people in, you know, the pastry business. But they'll ship to you just like they'll ship to any one of us. And, you know, you can share this kind of thing. The other thing is they have Van Houten's or Van Druten's cocoa. And you can only get this like in 5-pound sacks. And this is one of the paragons of cocoa when you talk about great cocoa flavor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when a recipe calls for cocoa instead of chocolate.
Mm-hmm.
So look for Lindt. Mm-hmm. Look for Valrhona, always 71%. And if you're in the world of cocoa, the Van Houten, and try New York Cake. And the other thing is, I would go on the web, go to Google, type in mail order chocolate, and see what you run across.
Oh, super. Well, thank you so much. I'm just so excited.
Well, this is good. You will now have a supply of chocolate for the whole neighborhood.
All right, great.
Take care, Laura.
Okay, thanks. Bye-bye.
There's a brand new competition. It's on a global scale, it's rough and tumble, and it's all about brilliant pastry work. It's the World Pastry Championship, and it was just fought in Las Vegas. Teams came from all over the world, including the USA. And guess what? We took the gold. Well, we have on the phone the man who created the World Pastry Competition, Norman Love. Norman, thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So, Norman, how did the American team get selected?
Well, every even year, we have what's called our World Pastry Team Championship, and every odd year, we have a National Pastry Team Championship. So the American team were the winners of the National Pastry Team Championships last year.
So who was our team? Who were those folks?
There were three gentlemen, Jean-Philippe Maury, who is the pastry chef at the Bellagio Hotel in Las Vegas,
uh-huh.
Jean-Claude Canestrier, who is the pastry chef of the Paris Hotel, and Laurent Ronlard, who is the pastry chef of the Ritz-Carlton in Atlanta, Georgia.
Gee, I wonder what language was being spoken in the kitchen at that time.
They are three very, very talented chefs, and they obviously not only won the competition, but they performed with incredible accuracy and skill.
Now, what did they make?
The competition takes place over 2 days, Friday and Saturday, with the theme, overall theme in the competition of circus this year. All the teams had to create chocolate artistry or a chocolate centerpiece, sugar, a sugar centerpiece, themed also in circus. They had to produce chocolate candies, petit fours, ice cream cakes, chocolate cakes, and plated desserts. They're allowed to come to the competition with only the raw ingredients in unmarked containers, previously scaled, and nothing else. And during the 13-hour period, they have to follow the curriculum exactly. They're judged by 24 judges, two from each of the countries represented, and they're judged on different areas of work, which is a very 33% of the scores were work, which was comprised of organizational skills, cleanliness, efficiency, and technical ability. They were judged on taste, of course, very, very strong area, taste, and thirdly, on artistry. So at the end of the competition, all of their artistic pieces are placed onto a small buffet, which is then judged on difficulty, on how it complies with the theme, color, contrast, texture, difficulty level, and so on.
Were there any tense moments? I mean, were there any goofs?
Well, I think, you know, any time that you have an international competition, we give away $125,000, making it the richest culinary event in the world. The intensity on a global level, any time that these professionals come together, and I have to say that the level of professionals that attended this year's World Championship, probably the highest level of professional that has ever been put under one roof in one competition. So is there tense moments? The Canadian team's sugar sculpture crashed to the ground as it was being brought to their presentation table. You have judges with clipboards in and out of your kitchens watching every single move that you make. So the stress level, the intensity is so high.
Oh, my
goodness.
It's
amazing.
So the American team took the gold?
The American team took the gold. The French team took the second place, and the Belgium team took the bronze.
Well, Norman, thank you very much.
It's my pleasure.
Norman Love is the creator of the World Pastry Team Championship. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us, everybody. And remember, you can call us anytime. The number's 800-537-5252. Until next week, let me leave you with this poetic thought from Ralph Waldo Emerson. He said, "I expand and live in the warm day like corn and melons." Information you will ever need is up on our website, splendidtable.org. Now, if it's not there, you probably really don't have to have it. Again, that address is splendidtable.org. And while you're visiting, drop us a line at the Splendid Table forum and take a look at the Splendid Table store. All the proceeds go to support the show. Our producer is Sally Swift, with help from Jennifer Russell. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. The Splendid Table is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed nationwide by Public Radio International. Have a great week, and join us next time. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
PRI. Public Radio International.